This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd. Former President Donald Trump's legal team will start its case on Friday with the object of proving that the former president was not responsible for the deadly January 6th riot at the Capitol building. As AP's Sagar Meghani reports, Democrats closed out their case against the former president on Thursday.
For 2 days, prosecutors said Trump spent months riling up backers with claims that the election was stolen, then summoned them to Washington and ordered them to fight like hell.
He said it, and they did it.
House impeachment manager Jonah Goose and fellow prosecutors said the rioters who ransacked the Capitol say they acted on what they saw as a direct order from the commander-in-chief, mounting a deadly attack to what prosecutor Ted Lieu called the president's glee.
President Trump did not once condemn the attack.
Trump's lawyers are expected to take less than a day to present their case, and the ex-president is likely to be acquitted, with several Republicans saying the Democrats' case did not sway them. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Court papers reveal new details about a man accused in last month's deadly riot at the U.S. Capitol. AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Thomas Caldwell is described by authorities as the leader of the far-right Oath Keepers militia group. Court papers show Caldwell discussed the possibility of getting a boat to ferry heavy weapons across the Potomac River. Days earlier, his lawyer said Caldwell had a top-secret security clearance for decades and had worked for the FBI. The Bureau has not responded. Prosecutors say the Oath Keepers communicated during the Capitol attack about the location of lawmakers. And at one point, Caldwell received a message saying all members are in the tunnels under the Capitol, seal them in, turn on gas. Caldwell denies he's a member of the Oath Keepers. Ed Donahue, Washington.
This is VOA News. President Joe Biden is announcing the United States will be receiving hundreds of millions of additional doses of COVID-19 vaccines by the summer, accelerating the schedule for vaccinations. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
President Biden visiting the National Institutes of Health, where scientists created the Moderna vaccine, praised workers, but criticized his predecessor for not securing enough doses or a distribution plan. Biden then announced 200 million new doses from Moderna and Pfizer and a sped-up delivery for another 100 million already ordered.
We're now on track to have enough supply for 300 million Americans by the end of July.
And soon, Johnson & Johnson's vaccine could come online.
We need more people to get vaccinated to beat this pandemic.
Biden warns the new variant strains could worsen the COVID caseload. He urges people to not let up on wearing masks.
I know it's a pain in the neck, but it's a patriotic responsibility.
Jackie Quinn, Washington.
The number of Americans filing for unemployment fell slightly last week, AP's Ben Thomas reports.
While first-time claims for jobless benefits were down at 793,000, they remain evidence job cuts remain high. The Labor Department report also revised its numbers from a week ago upward, now showing 812,000 applied for benefits. Before coronavirus infections erupted in the U.S. last March, weekly applications for jobless aid had never topped 700,000, even during the Great Recession. Nearly 10 million jobs remain lost to the pandemic. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Musician Chick Corea has died of a rare form of cancer that was discovered only recently, according to his website. He was 79. AP's Margie Zaraleta reports.
Chick Corea's song Spain is considered a jazz standard, along with 500 Miles High, La Fiesta, and Windows. He had 23 Grammys and is nominated for two more this year. Corea put out solo albums before replacing Herbie Hancock and Miles Davis's group in 1968. Corea later formed the group Circle and returned to Forever. Corea's style included classical, jazz, Latin jazz, and solo piano. He told the Associated Press last year, like a runner runs because it feels good, he plays piano because it feels good. I'm Archie Zaraleta.
Lucasfilm says Gina Carano is no longer a part of the Mandalorian cast after many online called for her firing over a social media post that likened the experience of Jews during the Holocaust to the U.S. political climate. She posted that Jews were beaten in the streets, not by Nazi soldiers, but by their neighbors. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd, VOA.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Friday, February 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. WHO recommends AstraZeneca vaccine in African countries with variant COVID-19 strand.
If cases remain mostly mild and moderate and don't require critical care, then we can save many lives. So my message to people, go out and get vaccinated when a vaccine becomes available in your country.
A strike by Lesotho health workers continues in the second week. Kenya's government presents its 2020-2021 fiscal year budget to parliament. Ghana's Supreme Court says it cannot force the Electoral Commission chair to testify. And organizers in Nigeria are planning another End SARS protest tomorrow, Saturday.
You cannot issue threats against the Nigerian people who have a constitutional duty to protest. The constitution has said Nigerians can protest. Who is Lai Mohammed to say otherwise? Who is Lagos State Police Commissioner to say otherwise?
And Human Rights Watch says Zimbabwe is among African countries using COVID-19 to crack down on press freedom. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Health Organization says the Oxford AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine can save lives and recommends using it even in African countries where variant strains of COVID-19 are circulating. The WHO said there are 3.7 million coronavirus infections, including nearly 100,000 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Since the first case of COVID-19 was identified in Africa nearly 1 year ago, the coronavirus, which causes the disease, has mutated. The continent now is faced with variant strains that are more dangerous and deadly. The World Health Organization says 8 countries have reported a highly contagious variant first found in South Africa, and 6 have seen another variant detected in Britain. In the wake of the mutations, South Africa said this week it would suspend use of the AstraZeneca vaccine because it is not effective in preventing mild and moderate infections. However, WHO Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moeti, notes the vaccine appears to prevent severe cases of COVID-19 and hospitalization. Therefore, she says, its use would be a great boon to Africa's hospitals and healthcare systems, which are greatly overstretched.
If cases remain mostly mild and moderate and don't require critical care, then we can save many lives. So my message is to people, go out and get vaccinated when a vaccine becomes available in your country. Ensuring equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines and sustaining the public health measures are the critical priorities to overcome this crisis.
The South African government has said it will continue to use the AstraZeneca vaccine under trial conditions among older healthcare workers to get better data on its impact on more severe forms of the disease. Meanwhile, Moeti says the international vaccine facility known as COVAX will begin a rollout of some 96 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine in Africa later this month. Moeti says the WHO is contacting governments to inform them about the recommendations issued by agency experts for use of the AstraZeneca vaccine.
An analysis of the risks and benefits with regard to using this vaccine needs to be made, and particularly to the neighboring countries, to South Africa, where the interaction is very intense, and we certainly know in several of those this variant is circulating. Well, of course, supporting and advising all the countries in the region.
Moeti also says the WHO was able to procure a small amount of Pfizer vaccine for distribution in 4 African countries. She says, though the quantities are small, they will provide those countries with experience on how to use the vaccine. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A strike by Lesotho healthcare workers to demand comparable salaries continues in its second week. This as the country is dealing with a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic. The nurses accuse the government of failure to implement what they call the public-private partnership or the PPP agreement. They also are demanding personal protective equipment against the deadly virus. Lesotho government officials were not immediately available for comment. Shlalifan Sewa Holimo is the Secretary General of the Lesotho Nurses Union.
We are on the second week being on strike, and the reason for them being on strike is because of non-compliance of the government on the PP agreement. Two is because of the other nurses that has been employed or been sent to Tsepo to do the same job that is doing by Tsepo employee, and over and above that, those people who are not even familiar with that work of referral hospital, which is Tsepo, are expected to be trained by Tsepo employee. But when it comes to the salaries, despite that they are doing the same job, despite that those people are new and they don't know this job, they're going to be trained by Tsepo, they're going to earn more salary than the one that is working at Tsepo.
You are on strike during the COVID-19 pandemic. Can we say that you have abandoned your professional duty, which is to take care of the health of the nation?
Their professional duties has never been abandoned. They are still taking care of employees, just that not entirely the workforce of the nurses. Some are in, some are not proceeding with the work. There are some sort of called a skeleton in order to take care of the patients.
What would it take for you to end your strike?
The only thing that will end the strike is for the government to ensure that Tsepo is reviewing the salaries of employees, not only nurses, all the workforce, because they are not paid in terms of the PP agreement, and they are also paid less than what the government employee are earning, while their duties and responsibility are not the same. Because what is important to be taken into consideration is that Tsepo is a referral hospital. All the government clinics and hospital, whatever challenges they have during their operation, they refer their cases to Tsepo with an expectation that is going to be addressed by Tsepo employees, the nurses, as well as the supporting staff. While the salaries are not the same, the government salaries is higher more than the one of Tsepo, including the benefits as well. That's the reason which we believe it can end the strike with immediate effect.
You have accused the government of not implementing the public-private partnership or the PPP agreement. What exactly is the PPP agreement and its significance?
What is very important to be taken into consideration is that the PP agreement has got what you call a financial model. And that particular document has indicated all the structures of Tsepo and each and every department on how much each particular employee should earn from a different department. So since the Tsepo has been operating, employees were not being paid according to that PP agreement, despite the fact that the government have been paying Tsepo the money that ought to have been paid in terms of that particular agreement.
Shlalifan Sewa Holimond is Secretary General of the Lesotho Nurses Union. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. A new Human Rights Watch report chronicles how more than 20 African governments are using the COVID-19 pandemic to clamp down on press freedom. The report says Zimbabwe's government, long known for repressing dissent, is one of the worst offenders. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
The report released Thursday says officials in Zimbabwe are cracking down on journalists, political opponents, health workers, and others who criticize the government's response to the COVID-19 crisis. Jerry Simpson is an associate director for Crisis and Conflict Division at Human Rights Watch.
In Zimbabwe, we've documented a number of incidents over the last year, and our report references three of those. A journalist that was beaten at a checkpoint near a lockdown area. We documented how a journalist was detained for 9 weeks for his COVID reporting. That was between July and November at various stages last year. And finally, we've noted how Zimbabwe introduced the 2020 Public Health Order Act in March, which threatened up to 20 years in prison for fake news reporting on public health matters.
Samson Takawira is a journalist with an online media outlet in Zimbabwe called 263 Chat. He is one of two journalists arrested last year for interviewing three opposition activists who were reportedly tortured by state security agents.
Our arrest served as a reminder to all other journalists, all other media people, not to pursue the story, because Obviously, this was a ploy to silence the people. This was a ploy by government to hinder its citizens from knowing the truth, what really had transpired to these ladies. No wonder why, even their bail conditions, they were not supposed to speak to the media.
Simpson of Human Rights Watch mentioned Uganda and Malawi as other countries where authorities have cracked down hard on journalists trying to cover the pandemic. Human Rights Watch wants the UN Human Rights Council meeting later this month to commission a new report focusing on states' compliance with their rights obligations in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, including the impact of restrictions on free speech and peaceful assembly. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, February 12. The government of Kenya says it plans to spend $1.1 billion more on its 2020-2021 budget, which was presented to Parliament on Wednesday this week. A 4.1% jump from the original plan presented in June last year shows that the 2020-2021 budget continues to face challenges, including the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic that has paralyzed the economy. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, Kenya's bilateral partners have agreed to defer loan repayment worth 77.8 billion Kenyan shillings as economists warn of economic crisis following massive job losses last year.
Kenya, just like any other country across the world, is in an economic crisis. The supplementary budget estimates presented to Parliament shows that the fiscal year 2020-2021 budget continues to face challenges. Among them, effects of COVID-19 pandemic, which slowed down the economic performance, as well as underperformance of projected revenues in the first half of the financial year. An economist, Ali Kansacho, says that Kenya's revenue might not be in a position to fund the supplementary budget and will have to seek loan from International Monetary Fund to survive. He says the Kenyan government has misplaced its priorities in terms of spending.
It's very difficult to understand where the money's going to come from. At the moment, Kenya's relying on its geoeconomic positioning and therefore on the likes of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to support the shortfall, which is going to be very dramatic. The key issue in terms of stabilizing the debt gap is the cost of government. The government somehow imagines that Santa Claus and unfortunately needs to bring more discipline to its own spending.
Early last month, Kenya's bilateral partners agreed to defer a loan repayment worth $778 million, giving the country a break at a time when its finances are in bad shape. This repayment break has helped the government to increase its spending for the current financial year by $700 million through the supplementary budget tabled before Parliament for approval. Mr. Sacho says Kenya will have to figure out how to pay their interest rates to its bilateral partners when in good shape economically.
Kenya is pushing out the moment of reckoning, which will come. And at that point, Kenya will have to work out with its bilateral partners, Eurobond holders, how it's going to return to a more sustainable trajectory, because the current trajectory is simply unsustainable.
In the draft budget policy statement for 2021-2022, Kenya's Treasury Cabinet Secretary Ukuri Yatani said that the budget has been done at a time when the current unfavorable microeconomic conditions have adversely affected revenue performance. Kenya is also preparing for a referendum mid this year, as Mr. Sacho faults the political class for setting aside money for an election that is not an emergency to Kenyans.
The referendum, I think the recent polling shows it has a popularity of less than 20%. It doesn't resonate with the citizens, and the economy is clearly suffering a body blow. But you wouldn't know that if you listen to the political discussion, which is very much divorced from the reality on the ground. The economy remains under tremendous pressure, And it's remarkable that the government is not paying more attention to that.
Kenya getting a debt repayment break has helped the National Treasury to meet critical financial obligations. The Kenyan government has also had difficulty paying healthcare workers at a time when the country has been grappling with the COVID-19 pandemic, which has threatened the healthcare system. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
In Nigeria, organizers of the End SARS protest are planning another demonstration tomorrow, Saturday, at the Lekki Toll Gate in Lagos. But Information Minister Lai Mohammed is warning the organizers that any violence will not be tolerated. Local media reports the minister is asking the organizers to cancel the planned protest. Organizers say the purpose of the protest is to demand justice for those killed during the last End SARS demonstration. Deji Adeyanju is convener of Concerned Nigeria, a political pressure group and one of the organizers of the planned protest. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that Nigerians have the right to peacefully demonstrate despite strong opposition from the information minister.
We have seen a need now, once again, to mobilize, to strategize, to synergize with people who share the same ideologies with us. Myself, Omoyele Sowore, and so many others are talking, and we are strategizing and mobilizing ahead of the protest on Saturday. It's instrumental to note that the approach of government has not changed. It's that of tyranny, repression, attacks, brutalization, and criminalization of freedom of assembly. You know, and this must not be accepted in a democracy, because even under the military, people protested. We are not bothered in any way by all the rhetoric, the threats. You know, we are determined to send the message, you know, to the government and to fellow citizens that in a democracy, people have the right to protest.
I understand the Lagos police are saying that they will not allow any protest scheduled for Saturday. What do you say to that?
They have no such powers. You know, the Lagos Police Commissioner is one of the profound enemies of democracy in Nigeria. You know, he has made his stand clear, you know, throughout the period of the End SARS and even after. And today, you know, the remarks attributed to him are shameful and it's an affront on our constitutional democracy. You know, if our country was a lawful country, he would be removed from office immediately.
Alhaji Lai Mohammed, the information minister, warned that the government will not tolerate any incidents of violence during the protest. Although he said that you have a constitutional right to protest, he said those who engage in acts of violence will be dealt with. Your response to that?
One thing, however, that we want to assure them this time that things are going to be different. You know, the last time they did it and got away with it because the Trump administration was only concerned about what happened in America. You know, and the new occupants in the White House, Joe Biden, will not tolerate flagrant abuse of human rights, mass murder of protesters. I am sure of that. You know, and people like Lai Mohammed, they need to understand that there must be consequences for their actions, for their utterances, and for the kind of things that they continue to justify. You cannot issue threats against the Nigerian people who have the constitutional duty to protest. The Constitution has said Nigerians can protest. Who is Lai Mohammed to say otherwise? Who is the Lagos Police Commissioner to say otherwise?
What is this planned demonstration at Lekki Toll Gate seek to achieve? What do you seek to achieve?
It seeks to achieve justice. People were massacred at the toll gate. Justice has not been served. The people, they are thinking of reopening the toll gate to start collecting blood money in the name of toll at the gate. That is an affront on the innocent lives that were shed at the toll gate. You know, so the Nigerian people need to come together to tell themselves, you know, a simple truth that our country is not working and that we have a collective duty, whether you are in uniform, whether you are not, to make our country work for all, not for a few individuals who make billions at the toll gates, who make billions in government house, who make billions by just sitting in the offices and writing and inflating contracts. That the country must work for all. That is the irreducible minimum and obligation we owe our country. And I must repeat that patriotism is not loyalty to the leader. Patriotism is loyalty to the best interests of the Nigerian people.
Deji Adeyanju is convener of Concerned Nigeria, a political pressure group and one of the organizers of Saturday's planned protest. He was speaking to viewers Peter Clotty.
The Supreme Court of Ghana says it cannot force Electoral Commission Chairperson Jean Adukwe Mesa to testify and be cross-examined about the December 7, 2020 presidential election. Mesa and the commission are first respondent to former President John Dramani Mahama's petition challenging the results of the election. Former President Mahama's lawyers had asked the court to compel Mesa to testify. Martin Webu, a Ghanaian lawyer, explains the Supreme Court ruling.
Today, the Supreme Court of Ghana upheld the respondent, that is to say, Electoral Commission and the sitting president, the application to close their case. So that means that effectively, the actual hearing of the case, that is to say, taking evidence from witnesses, has concluded. In other words, the other side of it is that Mr. John Mahama's lawyer's request that the court should rather let the Electoral Commission chair testify was denied. Now, once the court has made this decision, Mr. Mahama's lawyers have an option to apply to the court again for a subpoena. That is to say, this time they want to use a compulsory process to compel the chair of the Electoral Commission to testify. That application has been filed and should be heard sometime next week.
The court says it doesn't have the power to compare a witness to testify. What does that mean?
Yes. So you see, it's all about the nature of the application. So we have two principles of law, which is that when a party is before the court and somebody is before the court, either as plaintiff or as a defendant or respondent, the court cannot compel that person to give evidence as a party, okay? So it's up to that party to choose whether to give evidence or not to give.
That was Martin Webu, a Ghanaian lawyer, speaking with us from the capital, Accra. Now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the Royal Moroccan Football Association, who has asked the Confederation of African Football to either postpone or move Saturday's Champions League clash between Moroccan side Wydad Casablanca and South Africa's Kaizer Chiefs to another country. Chiefs were supposed to travel to Morocco on Wednesday night to honor the group stage continental fixture, but the North African country refused to issue visas to Amakosi, citing safety and health fears as a reason after a spike in COVID-19 cases in South Africa. In a one-liner correspondence sent to the South African Football Association, CAF, through its competition division manager, Ahmed Salem, said CAF will communicate the updated decision in due time. Amakosi have, however, incurred travelling costs, but at least are keen in playing their first ever match in the Champions League group stages. Staying with the Confederation of African Football, the mini-league stage of the 2020-2021 Total CAF Champions League kicks off this weekend. And here are the fixtures. In Cairo, it will be Al Ahly of Egypt versus El Merrikh of Sudan. AS Vital del Congo will be a home as a welcome Simba of Tanzania. In Group B in Lubumbashi, it will be TP Mazembe versus CR Belouizdad of Algeria, while Mamelodi Sundowns will play host to Al Hilal of Sudan. In Group C, Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa were expected to travel to Casablanca to face Wydad Casablanca, but that match is now put on hold, while Horoya of Guinea will be in Nyongo to welcome Petro Atletico of Angola. In Group D, Osporos will be at home as a welcome Tregat of Senegal, while MC Alger of Algeria will travel to Cairo to play Zamalek of Egypt. From the CAF Champions League to Qatar, where the 2021 edition of the FIFA Club World Cup was concluded on Thursday. Al Ahly of Egypt, African club champions who represented the continent at the tournament, claimed the Club World Cup's bronze medal for a second time after beating South American champions Palmeiras 3-2 on penalties, following a goalless draw at Qatar's Al Dorain Education Stadium on Thursday. El Shenawy, in their treble-winning campaign last season, produced two superb saves in the shootout to lead the Red Devils to a remarkable victory over their fancied opponents. Coach Pitso Mesomane was full of praises for his players for winning two of their three matches at the FIFA Club World Cup tournament. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, February 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.